It's time to get down to business with $30 a month business internet. WOW Business offers 99.9% network reliability so that you can keep your business moving. $30 a month gets you 30 megabytes per second with 24/7 US-based support, a price lock guarantee, and a 60-day satisfaction guarantee. Lock in our lowest priced offer for the support you need. Go to switchtowellbusiness.com. Offer for new customers with a 2-year agreement subject to change. Prices do not include taxes, fees, and equipment charges. Restrictions apply.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier, Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the weekend, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars, and this is episode 181. First and foremost, let me apologize for the break of 1 week where I did not produce a show, did not send you a show, and of course, those of you who are attentive and sign in, week out, will have noticed that. But it was through no fault of my own. Given the disaster in Mocoa, as you will have seen on the international news, given this disaster, I was worked thoroughly for the last few days, for the last week, articles, international television appearances, and so on and so forth. And in truth, as you can imagine, the work was quite draining. Of course, nothing like what the poor people of Mocoa and Putumayo have been suffering, but of course, it meant that my time was taken up by other issues. And so let's just take a moment to think about this absolute tragedy in Mocoa, Putumayo. So it's Putumayo is on the border with Ecuador, and Mocoa is in the northern section of that department, where presently it's above 270 people who have lost their lives, probably around 80 children, all of whom were washed away by a wall of mud and debris, trees, vehicles, houses, when they were in their beds on Friday night, Saturday morning, early Saturday morning. And of course, there was increased rainfall in Putumayo, in Mocoa, where that day they received 30% of the total rain for 1 month. And of course, we have La Niña taking place on the Pacific side, which is increased rainfall. And of course, there are other reasons to it. The disaster in Mocoa occurred, and studies doesn't help now, but studies have been reported over the years that Mocoa was an imminent disaster zone due to deforestation in the region for cattle farming, and of course, man's influence in the region. These hills around Mocoa, it's hilly, it's jungled. These hills around Mocoa are largely made up of a volcanic ash deposits, which are unstable. And of course, when the hills are super saturated with water in such a situation, and the people displaced from other parts of the country due to the violence, living on these precarious conditions alongside the river, this is what happens. And the images are obviously scarring. The situation has been dreadful. And yes, our hearts go out to Mocoa. If you are interested in donating, the Colombian Red Cross will receive donations. You can, I believe you can pay with your credit card. Also, there is the outfit, which is known as the Patrulla Aérea. This is an air patrol. It's a private charity which flies doctors out all over the country into lesser known, lesser visited areas, and they have on their website, that's Patrulla Airia. It's on the Facebook page. I put it there. .org. They have a list of things that's needed and you can pay on your credit card there. They also have a link to Mercado.com, which is a market, a supermarket, which have specific things that the people in Mocoa require as well. And you can pay with your credit card. So you can pay as little as you want, but send down important, aid, medicines, water, of course, basic foodstuffs, things like blankets, mattresses. At the moment, those who have been displaced by the disaster are living in schoolrooms and gyms and things like that, and all over the place. It's the fear is that it might occur again. That's the fear at the moment. So that's Mocoa, unfortunate disaster, dreadful disaster in the southwest of Colombia, near to the border with Ecuador. I know you're all thinking about them, and of course, anything that you can do, anything that you can possibly spare, please send it down to Mocoa. Now, I had promised you episode 181 to be a little bit of a reflection on my weekend, a weekend away in San Jose de Guaviare, let's say you've got Bogota, and then you've got Meta, which is the department below it, and then you've got Guaviare, the department below that. So, yes, I was there. I was down there. I flew down there for three nights, to visit the FARC, temporary camp, let's say. Let's say this FARC temporary camp in Las Colinas. It's called Las Colinas. It's actually called Jaime Leal Pardo, after the assassinated leader of the Unión Patriótica. That's another story. But I was down there for a few days, and I was able to get out to Las Colinas taking full advantage of a couple of friends of mine who are working in the region or working in public entities, international entities down there. So let's reflect a little bit on this visit. I'd been down to Guaviare before, 7 years ago. I did articles, you'll be able to find them online, on the BBC and so on, about the displacement of the Nucac Macu tribe. So not good news out of Guaviare. And Guaviare deserves some good news, because the tourism, ecotourism potential of this department is without bounds. That's the truth. But of course, Guaviare is one of the flashpoints of the Colombian conflict. You've got the colonos, or the colonizing class, have moved in the marimbero years, the marijuana years, and then that became the rubber years, and then that became the coca years. And of course, Guaviare is a largely unsettled department, very close to the rest of Colombia, really, and of course, strategic, because there are rivers, big rivers that lead out to Brazil and Venezuela. So therefore, for the transshipment of illicit materials, this is perfect. The FARC guerrillas have run most of Guaviare, what is not run by paramilitary groups. And so there has been a huge state presence in the form of the army, but the army sticks to themselves and they do their patrols and so on, and then disappear. And then the alternative authorities, whether it be the guerrilla or the paramilitaries, take over. So that's sort of Guaviare in a nutshell. So I was down there again, and I got to speak to a local journalist, local policeman, some other locals, and of course go out to the FARC camp. And I know that's what you're more interested in, is the FARC camp. So we bundled over 25 kilometers of dirt road, which took over 2 hours. We passed a town called El Capricho, where the UN and other aid workers have been informed by the local townsfolk to not stop and buy anything there, to not stop, you know, to try and socialize the issues in Colombia. Do not buy an empanada on your way out. Do not buy a gaseosa, a soda drink, because the people have been infiltrated by the paramilitaries. And therefore, the paramilitaries do not look fondly upon those working, let's say, to reintegrate the demobilizing FARC guerrillas. Now, this Las Colinas has up to, so it's around 550 men and women of the guerrillas living there. That's the several columns. There's five columns of the FARC. That's the Bloque Oriental. It's run by El Medico, Mauricio Jaramillo, who has several aliases, but you'll be able to see any search online for Mauricio El Medico. He received me as well as Ivan Ali. Mauricio El Medico told me that he was from El Líbano in Antioquia, but grew up in Tolima, and of course I've checked that online, and of course it doesn't seem so. So therefore they're filtering the information, of course, given to me. But Ivan Ali is from Maicao. He is from the Guajira, and that was quite clear. Anyway, so there's 550-odd guerrillas on this. It was a Sunday when I came through, so they were on their day off, and it was a mini football tournament, just like any other sort of small, out-of-the-way Colombian town. Everyone was around the football pitch. That was the social area. People were doing their things. Families were visiting. There was sort of like a reception area. And of course, as we were leaving, before I was leaving, the huge truck of food turned up as well. So that's how they're sustaining themselves. Now, I think, of course, the most interesting was sitting down with guerrillas. I was a little bit apprehensive, I'm not going to lie. Of course, I mean, it's not ordinary to head out to a guerrilla camp and chat with people who have been, these crimes against humanity, kidnapping, forced displacement, disappearances, assassinations, extortions, landmines, you name it, they've been involved. This is the truth. It's effectively since 1964, but I was out there and I was received incredibly well. I mean, we were looked after hand and foot. Had I stayed longer, they would definitely have given us food. There's no doubt about it. It was a Colombian pueblo. But I sat down and I had time to chat a little bit of politics and a little bit of the reality in Colombia with the guerrillas. Of course, as a journalist, to put a filter on some of the things that are being said. I want to believe, I want to understand further what's going on. But of course, you need to put a filter on. There's been so much disinformation. And of course, that phrase from nowadays, half truths taking place. If I ever raised a question about the minors, the underage, the children who are in the rank and file in the FARC still and who have not been handed over, the question was carefully evaded, never answered. But anyway, so we're on the camp, and so the conversation starts with chit-chat. And like every conversation here in Colombia, we talk about nothing. It was almost about 20 minutes of nothing, talking about the drains in London, talking about Cuba, talking about the metro, etc., things that fascinate, until they've won over a confidence. And we're sitting in their sort of kiosk, and I can see the construction taking place. They're building 250 houses. There's a civilian contractor from Bogota who previously lived in, or who had rented a place to live in El Capricho, the town of which I spoke earlier. He had received death threats living there close to the camp because he was working for the camp. So now he's living on the camp for his own security. This is a young man from Bogota just doing his job. Anyway, 250 homes. They were all sort of skeletal looking because just the frames were up and the foundations were in. And of course, they're putting in sewage works and they're putting in the cables for electricity. So to me, it's completely clear that after D-Day plus 180 days, so the 180 days since coming into the temporary camps, they're not leaving. They're staying. The guerrilla will stay. These are their pueblos, and they are going to live in these pueblos despite what the government says. And this is going to give further ammunition to the opposition, saying that these are republiquetas de las FARC, employing the language of the 1960s. About this, my question is: well, what's the worst that could happen? They have their own little towns that they make them work. I don't know. Is that me being naive? But there's 250 houses being constructed for this 550 people. So all the family units can stay. They're constructing a clinic. There's a bakery going up. There's a school going up. Everything's very included. They've got saplings out that they're going to plant. They've got it seriously organized. But for the time being, being, they're not living in these places. They're still living in the jungle. Of course, it's the fringes of the camp, which is still jungle. And they're underneath the plastic tarps. Of course, the homes and everything was meant to be ready, the government had promised, and which gives rise to the belief that really the government signed the peace agreement with the FARC and then sort of washed their hands of it. It's done. So what? But of course, it's the hardest time now is the socialization, the information being doled out to Colombians. And of course, convincing the FARC as well, the 7,000 odd men and women who are now distributed around 26 different, camps around the country, that the government and the Colombian people are prepared to take them on, prepared to adopt them, let's say. So anyway, that is the first thing coming through, but it's both sides which are breaking the rules. I mean, that's the truth. The government has broken the rules in not having the camps ready. The FARC is breaking the rules in other circumstances. Of course, there's the dissidents of the FARC as well. They wouldn't talk to me about that. They say they have nothing to know about that because that's the dissidents. That's Frentes Uno and Siete, so one and seven. That's Mordisco, alias Mordisco, and Gentil Duarte, which are running now the contraband in the area. They control the strategic routes out into Brazil through Valpez, I believe it is, if I'm not mistaken. And of course, that's increased the coca production in the region. So but let's get back a little bit to the 18-hectare terrain where I was visiting. So of course, there was all sorts of talk about the complications, the government not fulfilling. But the real fear, of course, is paramilitarism. That's the real fear. That came up in every conversation. I was informed by the guerrillas that they had received threats down there in Guaviare. And of course, if there's any backing up that in Guaviare, San Jose de Guaviare itself, a week previous to my arrival, it had been pamphleted by people claiming to be the autodefensas gaitanistas de Colombia. Now, the autodefensas have been, and I have through back channels contacted them too, and they say they have no presence in the area. But of course, these autodefensas are heavily linked to other criminal gangs in the region, so I think that's probably a lie. Anyway, the pamphlets were ones of the social cleansing, that people dealing drugs, people taking drugs, thieves, etc., will be disappeared. So the same usual unpleasant realities. But they also, the FARC, were able to confirm that the AGC might be there and the Urabeños on the other side. And to confirm this, extortions and protection fees have increased massively through the region. This is what's coming out. This is what the campesinos, the country folk are saying. So pretty scary stuff there. So what's being done? I don't know. I don't know what the government is truly doing, because at the end of it, the FARC have abandoned strategic territories across the country, which have had no state presence. And the FARC has been a de facto state and kept it in line. This is not to say it's a good thing. But I asked El Medico, part of the political team. He was in Cuba. He was in Havana, Cuba for the peace talks. He is the guy that said in 2016 that kidnapping was an error made by the FARC. So it's quite an amazing turnabout. Very educated man, clearly studied medicine. He was the general practitioner, the specific doctor for Manuel Marulanda when he was alive, the former leader of the FARC. But I asked him about what's going on, and he says that his response was that the army was deliberately allowing access to these zones by the paramilitaries because there are economic ends here in the cities and in the pockets of industrialists to permit this to take place. So you make of it what you will. Make of it what you will. I mean, it could be, basically, he could be brainwashing me, he could be lying, he could be saying anything, but it's interesting to think about. I mean, these are people who live on the land. These are people who know the land. They chose this spot here outside of El Capricho because they knew the land. And let's come back to that, is that they will not leave after 180 days. They know what the cost of the land is. It's around 4 million pesos per hectare. There are 18 hectares. It's not the most expensive piece of land, but it's got two quebradas, two little streams on it. So there's a water supply. It's clearly not bad land at all, and it's easy to defend. So there's some key things there. You can see they've kind of dug in on this area. You know, they're not completely without without their backups there. So it's an interesting situation. Of course, in every conversation with the left wing, let's say the ultra left wing, Venezuela comes up, the admiration for Venezuela, the hatred for the USA. It's the same, much of the same chatter. But it, you know, you have to filter it out, don't you? You have to filter it out. And of course, the anti-Uribe sentiment, basically at the end of it, it's, the FARC believe that Uribe and his cohorts do not want peace. As an academic, I study this and I find it hard to believe that people would not want peace. But I do see there being economic interests across the country that have adapted, molded their way in a conflict to benefit themselves, of course. And I think that happens everywhere, but so fascinating. And let me just go on to describe a little bit more of the camp, because of course the homes weren't finished, but they will be finished at some point. I mean, I don't know if they'll be finished by the end of May, but they will be finished. Drains being put in, sewage systems, but the guys are living in the background in under their black plastic tarps, but they've got beds now. Previously, I didn't think they had beds, and there's these gaudy bed covers on the top of them. I mean, these small, simple luxuries that are clearly being enjoyed. And I think one anecdote from this visit, this fleeting visit on a Sunday, was not from the guerrillas themselves. My driver out there was a paisa from Medellin. He used to be a bus driver, most pro-Uribe, most anti-guerrilla person that you could possibly have driving you out to a guerrilla camp. And he would talk in the conversations on the way out, the 2 hours, about los bandidos and these rats and everything, dehumanizing language that has been employed and been in the employ of politicians here for a long time, so therefore it has spread. He would talk about this. We were a bit worried going in there, what he's going to do. Just remember to look everyone in the eye, always say thank you, always say please, and be appreciative. And of course, they doled out coffee. Our places were wiped down. I mean, we couldn't have been better looked after, in truth. And I could see that the paisa was somewhat shocked by this. He was somewhat taken aback that these people had manners, you know, and these animals that live in their jungle had manners. Anyway, while I was talking to El Médico and Ivan Ali and others, and we were just chatting away about realities and the government and so on, I kept checking out the corner of my eye where the paisa was, just in case he got us into trouble, because he's got this big 4x4 truck, this big Hilux, and there's no vehicles on in the actual camp itself, and so the guerrillas are needing to move some ovens, bread ovens, and they ask him if they can move in the truck, and so he's helping them out, he's helping them move and so on. You know, these are just people who need to get by at this time. And anyway, so we see them helping, and that's, wow, look at that. And at the end, he's deep in conversation for the rest of my period there. He's deep in concentration with a young FARC guerrillera. And she's there. She's got a bandana on. She's a bit sassy. She's quite sassy, you know. She's there's a swing to her hips and so on. And the Pais is obviously delighted to be talking to a young lady there. And anyway, I hear a bit of the conversation, but it's a regular conversation. She's kind of asking about how much he gets paid, his lifestyle, and so on and so forth. And at the end of it, she presents him with a bag of powdered milk so he can have his café con leche in the morning. You know, it's a big bag of powdered milk. When we get back in the car and we're zooming out and we're going through El Capricho, and everything's a bit tense, of course, in this area. And the paisa speaks up. He goes, "Qué persona tan formal." So what a gracious person. Those are the words, his absolute words. I mean, if you talk about it, what a gracious person. And she gave me this. And, you know, it was just an interaction between two human beings, of course, from very different situations presently, but I think from very similar situations in the past. You know, he's not a wealthy man. He's not a man who's been educated. He's not a man who's seen the world, and unlikely the señora, the guerrillera as well. Anyway, he kept repeating, "Que señora más graciosa, más formal." So what a gracious lady. And to me, that was the one thing, one really positive thing I could take out of it, and made me sort of scream out loud internally, but scream out loud. It's like, why hasn't the government done more to eliminate this sort of fishbowl sense that we have between the guerrillas and us. The guerrillas are there in their fishbowl camps and nobody can talk and nobody can talk about what's going on and nobody can socialize and be informed. And this is what the government has failed to do. The government has failed to inform the Colombian people and socialize the Colombian people and the benefits to Colombia, the benefits on a human level of a peace agreement. Now, we all have our doubts and there are skeptics out there, but I saw it. I spoke to the people. It was interesting. Of course, this is not a full representation of the 7,000 of them and the further thousands in urban militias and academics out there, but it was fascinating. So I am writing pieces about this, and which are hopefully going to be taken by places in the international press. And of course, I will post them on the Facebook site so that you can read them too about my experiences with the guerrillas in Guaviare. But until these issues are resolved, we have the elections coming up. We have D-Day plus 180 days. We have the hatred across Colombia. We have corruption. We have coca production increasing. I mean, there is so much to be done. But still, this is Colombia. Colombia has rolled with the punches and is still here. So there must be a solution to this. So I urge all of you out there listening, think about it. Just reflect on Colombia and let's see how together we can help somehow. Even one grain of sand, but let's see how we can help somehow. So that's me signing off for today. It's been a hard couple of weeks. I'm not going to lie. It's been a hard couple of weeks. So I wish you all the best on this Easter break in 2017. I'll be back next week with episode 182, talking further about Colombia with an interesting interviewee lined up. But thank you again for listening. Please get in touch. That's ColombiaCalling@gmail.com. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. Everything else. It's always a pleasure. Bye bye for now. La canoa de Bareque para llegar a...